Hello and welcome to Everyday Oral Surgery. This is your host, Dr. Grant Stuckey. I am an oral and maxillofacial surgeon practicing in Denver, Colorado. The goal of this podcast is to connect, learn, and inspire. In this podcast, you'll be hearing from OMS surgeons all over the globe discussing ways to improve the practice of oral and maxillofacial surgery. Most information shared in this podcast will be based on personal experience and opinions, so please supplement what you learn here with approved research studies. If you are a regular follower of the podcast, please go to our website, everydayoralsurgery.com, and register to receive newsletters and find links to our social media accounts. Most importantly, if you would like to be interviewed on the podcast or know someone who you'd like to hear from, or if there's a topic you'd like to hear about, please email me at grantstuckey@gmail.com. Without further ado, please enjoy today's episode. All right, welcome to another episode. Today I'm with Dr. Dan Hawkins. He's an oral and maxillofacial surgeon practicing in Virginia at VCU. Dan, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Grant. I really appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, this is great. I'm super excited to talk to you. Can you just start by giving us a brief kind of history of your training and your current practice setup?
Yeah, so I did my undergraduate degree at a small liberal arts school in Pennsylvania. I then went to obtain my dental degree from University of Pittsburgh, went on to match to VCU, where I did my oral maxillofacial surgery residency. While working at VCU, I actually got kind of the unique experience to get a chance to work with Dr. Joe Niamtu, who you've had on this podcast, does solely facial cosmetic surgery. So I was actually able to obtain my facial cosmetic surgery license upon completion of residency. I then graduated and took a full-time academic position here at VCU. This is my fourth year as faculty here now at VCU. And about 3 years into practice is when I applied to be a fellow of the American College of Surgeons, which we'll talk about that a little bit more. For my current practice setup, I do a little bit of everything. I do a fair amount of orthognathic and TMJ surgery, facial trauma, benign path and reconstruction, you know, outpatient dental implants, dental alveolar, and outpatient general anesthesia. My kind of specialized or sub-focused areas are more in facial cosmetic surgery, peripheral trigeminal nerve repair, and treatment of obstructive sleep apnea, and then also some kind of complex dental implant rehabilitation, while some of my colleagues perform the free flaps, kind of doing some of those cases simultaneously with them.
Nice. That's great. Yeah, thanks for giving us a rundown. Well, VCU is an awesome place. We've had several guests on the podcast from there. Dr. Abubakar, we talked to him. Dr. Niamtu, Dr. DeLuke, just tons of great people, and I'm glad to talk to you as well. So can you tell us a little bit about like what exactly is the American College of Surgeons and kind of, I know some of our listeners, probably a lot of them know, but a lot don't, so just give us some clarification there.
To explain it briefly, it's a society that, if selected into, demonstrates that you have a high surgical competence, hold yourself to a high standard of care, and provide quality ethical patient care. You know, to kind of quote their site, and again, I'm definitely by no means no official spokesperson of the ACS. So if I say something, you know, slightly incorrectly, don't hold it against me. But it's a society that selects surgeons whose education and training, professional qualities, and surgical competence, along with ethical conduct, have passed a rigorous evaluation that's set by the College of Surgeons. And they're dedicated to improving patient care through high surgical standards and optimizing optimal and ethical practice environments.
Okay. And what do they require to become a fellow of their college?
Yes, this is a kind of one of probably might be the highlight for any young surgeons or residents, you know, more senior residents looking to do this as they become young surgeons. It can be a little bit convoluted. I had to do some digging around on my own, which is one of the reasons why I kind of wanted to spread the word on this topic. So it's a little bit different if you're single or dual degree. Really the same criteria, you just have to go through a little bit different process. So for single degree surgeons, you must complete a OMFS waiver application cycle through the AAOMS site. So if you just go to the AAOMS site, go under the Member Center tab, And then under that, you'll see a little section that you can click on ACS Fellowship for single degree OMS. And through that, there's a whole list of things that you'll have to have for them, you know, pretty standard things for a lot of, so your CV, your degree, your licensure. One thing that you do have to have is you have to be board certified for at least a year prior to the ACS application deadline. So that's just one thing to keep in mind. You know, even if you feel like you're qualified after your first year of practice, you have to be a board certified for at least a year prior to your application. And then you also have to send them, of course, a case log. And so along with your case log, you also send three letters of recommendation from other ACS members. So those don't have to be OMS. They could be, you know, if you work in a hospital and you have a colleague, plastics or an ENT colleague that you work with, or some other colleague who's a member of the ACS, they can certainly write you a letter of recommendation as well. And then as far as your case log that you submit, generally, there's no specific number, but generally they're looking for about 50 major OR cases a year. So not, you know, extractions, implants, bone grafting in preparation for implants. And they're also looking for, you know, not to say that you couldn't just do one specific procedure 50 times in years, for example, like cut 50 osteotomies. You know, I don't know whether you'd get in or not, but they're also looking for a little bit of variety of procedures as well to show that you're, you know, a well-rounded surgeon, along with your, you know, letters of rec and everything else that they're judging you on. One other thing to mention too is that you do have to be practicing in that same location for about a year as well and hold hospital privileges there for a year as well without any reported events to the board or the hospital or anything. For the single degree applicants, after you have your application waiver approved through AMIS, then you have to reapply to the ACS directly, but they'll already have a lot of your information. And so you pretty much have everything you need. It's just a kind of a couple more clicks to send it through to the ACS. So that was all for the single degree applicants. For the dual degree applicants, you need a lot of the same things, pretty much everything the same, but you just skip the step of the waiver application through the AAOMS and you can apply directly through the ACS website. So that makes it a little bit more straightforward for the dual degree applicants. You can just do a quick Google search for the ACS and click on become a member, apply now, and then it'll list out all the requirements for you. So,
and then what are the big benefits of going through these applications and becoming a fellow of the ACS?
Yeah, I joined for three main reasons, I would say. One is that it allows us as OMS to be part of a larger legislative group to advocate for the best interest of surgeons in general. You know, we as OMS, out of the whole pie of surgical specialties, are a pretty small group. So it's always nice to be part of a larger legislative body. Another reason is that having these letters behind your name, FACS, you know, a lot of people don't know what they mean. Patients unlikely to know what they mean, but we know our patients today Google everything, right? So with a quick Google search, I think they could pretty quickly look up and within a few minutes, they'll understand that, oh, okay, this is what this stands for. This surgeon, you know, has been vetted by this higher group and has shown to be, you know, hold himself to not only high surgical standards, but, you know, as a pretty good person and performs their, you know, surgery or patient care with ethical conduct as well. A third reason I would say is to allow for continued interdisciplinary collaboration among other surgical specialties and to represent ourselves among the various surgical specialties, understanding, you know, just so they can understand as OMS, we can contribute our unique skill set and knowledge to offer optimal patient outcomes as well.
Terrific. Okay. Yeah, that's really helpful to know how to become it, what it entails. I think even a lot within our specialty, we see those the FACS, and I think a lot of people just assume that that means you went to a fellowship, or there's kind of a lot of confusion around that. It's good to know.
That's what I always assumed, like when I was in my first year residency or something, reading Peterson's, and I see, you know, like the FACS behind everyone's name. I didn't really know what it meant. I just assumed you did a fellowship, or I was like, oh, this person is extremely prolific in our field. You know, they have FACS behind their name, but I didn't really know what it meant.
That's great. I mean, just because I clicked on the tab here on Amos's website with their requirements. I mean, it seems like most people, so like board certified, you're out, you know, over a year, and people who are doing 50 major OR cases per year, seems like those are the main kind of requirements, right, to become a fellow. Anything else big I'm missing?
No, nothing else big other than just, you know, knowing some other surgeons that you can get some good letters of recommendation from who are also members of the ACS. But those are really the major things.
That's terrific. Yeah. Very helpful. Well, other question I was going to ask, I was going to say helpful for patients to see that, and hopefully they do their homework and look that up. But do you have any idea if there's any benefit with having the FACS insurances? Like, are you able to, you know, do any extra coding or billing or anything? I have no idea.
I do not believe so. Not that I'm aware of. You can get some discounts for like different insurances, like life insurances or different CE through the FACS. There can be discounts as far as that goes. You also have access to like the Journal of American College of Surgeons publications. So there are a little bit of perks in regards to that, but not as far as, you know, billing or coding that I'm aware of. So,
okay. Cause I know a lot of insurances, when you're applying for them, they'll ask you if you're board certified. And I think there's some insurances that has some bearing, and yeah, I don't know. You can negotiate. I don't know if you can negotiate better fees, or it's just something they advertise on their website. Yeah. I've never seen them ask about the American College of Surgeons. Anyways. Well, good. Excellent. So you've been out of residency a few years now. You're doing full-time academics. What advice do you have for young residents trying to figure out what to do with their careers?
Yeah, that's a great question. Sometimes I feel like I'm still figuring that one out. But first, I would just say, to as painful as it might be for if you're in your later residency years, take every single possible opportunity you can to learn, even when you're tired and frustrated, and not just from your own faculty, but from other specialties. I found that extremely beneficial in my training. So I tried to spend as much time as I could with, you know, our ENT colleagues here at VCU are great, as well as a lot of other specialties. So I spent a lot of time with ENT and plastics, oculoplastics, if you can, neurosurgery, and also some of your, if you happen to be at a program that is incorporated with a dental school, or even if you're not, trying to talk to private practice dental specialties. So, you know, learn from your orthodontist, prosthodontist, dare I even say periodontist. But yes, there's a lot of things that you can learn from them as well. So I think just making the extra effort during your last residency years is one piece of advice for any of our resident listeners. And, you know, even as a young surgeon, I think the barriers between specialties are hopefully becoming less and less. And I think if you approach people in the right manner, that they'll be willing to teach you. But by the same token, you always have to be willing to be there for them. So a lot of times that means just making yourself extremely available and approachable. If they ever ask you to do anything, oh yeah, I'll do it right away. Even if it's inconvenient for you or inconveniencing your schedule, go out of your way to help them. And that honestly has paid back tenfold for me just in these first couple years of my academic career working with different specialties. That's one piece of advice I'd have. Obviously, as an academic surgeon so far, I got to put in a little bit of a plug here. So I would say to just keep an open mind. Gosh, for example, so I think you also had one of my best friends, actually, Dan Tran, on the podcast before, and he, you know, unfortunately isn't in academics anymore, but he took the job at the same time I did. And prior to that, I don't think VCU produced an academic surgeon for, you know, 20 or 25 years coming straight out, you know, so it's kind of geared more towards that private practice mentality. And I'll be honest, I always thought I was going to be a private practice surgeon, go back with the surgeon that I shadowed growing up, but it's not how it ended up. You know, during my last year of residency, I really liked teaching our younger residents in the year below me. And I really liked doing kind of the full scope of major surgery. So that's, you know, a lot of what attracted me to academics. So I would just say for younger surgeons to just keep an open mind as that, you know, academics is a possibility. I know, you know, a lot of people kind of, or a lot of younger surgeons, you're in a lot of debt financially. And it is true that there are situations where academics can be, or you can maybe make a little bit less, but for the most part, you can live a very, very comfortable lifestyle financially in academics. You know, I don't think anyone in our specialty is hurting financially, even those in academics. So I wouldn't let the financial side deter you. It's a lot of fun. You know, every day is different and you get to work with young people who always want to try new things. So that's part of my job that I love.
Hey guys, real quick, KLS Martin is offering a 35% discount on my favorite KLS Martin instruments for everyday oral surgery listeners. So there's a link in the podcast notes with a full listing and a video highlighting some of the advantages of using KLS Martin instrumentation. To utilize this offer, use promo code STUCKYFAVES with a capital S and a capital F. So capital S, lowercase T-U-C-K-I, capital F, lowercase A-V-S. And you can use that through your KLS Martin sales rep or by emailing usa@klsmartin.com. I handpicked these instruments based on the kind of favorite extraction instruments that I use on a daily basis. And I hope you enjoy them.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think is probably the big deterrent for a lot of guys is just the mystery behind how much you make and thinking you can make tons more money as a private practice surgeon. But I hear the same things, and we've heard this on the podcast by academic surgeons that they do fine and it's not a struggle to survive or anything.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt. For a lot of my peers in the private practice in my same area, I'm making less money, but still doing plenty well enough. And a lot of it is institution dependent too, as far as that goes. One thing I would say, if you do have a lot of student loans, one thing that's not really done a lot in our specialty, because we, you know, a lot of us aren't employed by a hospital or solely by a hospital, I should say, but the public student loan forgiveness program that a lot of our medical colleagues do. So if you're in residency and you know or decide that you do want to be an academic surgeon and you have some student loans, which pretty much all of us do, I would highly encourage you to look into the public student loan forgiveness program. So that's, if you're not familiar with it, it's basically like this 10-year process, and then you can get a certain amount of your loans forgiven, which can end up being hundreds of thousands of dollars forgiven if you file all your paperwork correctly. So in your residency years count towards that. So really, that could be, you know, 6 years or however many years. And your fellowship, if you do a fellowship, that year counts for it too. So, you know, maybe within 5 years after graduating, you had a couple hundred thousand dollars forgiven off your loans, which that is also a perk to going in academics. I think, you know, the downside is you do have to kind of know that during your residency years to be able to qualify for that, but it is something that you could do. So
that's a great resource. Good to know. What are the cons of being in academics other than potentially pay? Do you get along with Dr. Strauss? That's what I'm trying to ask here.
Yeah. Hey, I get along great with Dr. Strauss now. I'm just kidding. You know, I love all our faculty here. I mean, you've had a lot of them on the podcast. We have a great working environment here. It's not malignant at all. And I think more and more programs are recruiting good faculty because, you know, that they know that those are the kind of people you want. You don't want people that are going to be, you know, jerks or excluding other people or putting other people down in a learning environment. But, you know, one con is you might not have quite as much control over what's going on in your day-to-day practice as in private practice. Sometimes, you know, just even things in our outpatient setting, even more so in the hospital, which no one really has that much control over, but just day-to-day decisions that you'll probably be able to just make in a few seconds in private practice. That is, everything is like a process to make any type of decision in an academic environment, which can be a good thing, but can also kind of slow things down. Fortunately here, you know, Dr. Obbacher has let me kind of take in the facial cosmetic thing and run with it. So I've been fortunate to be able to do a lot of that. And he's encouraged that quite a bit. So I can't complain too much about what I've been limited to do, honestly, in academics. I've pretty much more or less been able to kind of do what I want. So,
oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, great scope. I mean, you have access to tons of good learning. I mean, so fun being with residents, teaching them, learning from other surgeons. There's tons of pros. Super awesome. Any other words of wisdom you have for our listeners?
Words of wisdom. You know, I'm still pretty green, pretty novice. You know, I'm just a couple years into it. But I would just say, you know, overall, just keep an open mind. Even if you do decide, you know, that private practice is more your calling, I have lots of my really good friends that are in private practice and still do pretty full scope OMS. So, you know, just kind of remember why you got into this specialty and things that you really liked about it. And hopefully you can keep doing those as your career progresses. So those would kind of be some of my words of wisdom. And it's never too late to go back to academics. If you start in private practice for a couple years, you know, you can go back, or even 10 years in, you can go back to academics. One of our faculty, George Deeb, had a great private practice career, but decided mid-career to come back to academics. And he definitely has not regretted that decision.
Awesome. Yeah, I second that. I've done some part-time academics. I had friends that kind of went back to academics after doing years of private practice. And it's super rewarding. I think those people too can just bring a different perspective maybe than the guy who went right into academics.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So everyone's got something to offer. And so I think it's good for the residents to be exposed to a lot of different types of surgeons. Oh, quick question. How's Dan Tran doing these days?
He's doing really well. Yeah. His health is holding out. He's doing awesome. So he's actually going to do a 10K with function of one lung this spring. So that's something. Yeah.
Dude, he's doing better than me. I couldn't run a 10K if my life depended
on
it.
Yeah, no, he's doing great. Still see Dan all the time. So,
okay. Well, we end every podcast with some rapid fire questions. So first one is, what's the best book you've read in the past year?
I'll be honest, I'm not a huge reader other than reading OMS articles or textbooks or trying to start some of my own publications. But I am a little bit into the personal finance realm, just trying to be fiscally responsible. So the last book I read was, well, there's multiple white coat investor books, read those. And then the most recent book that I'm reading now is Financial Freedom RX. Most of my reading other than OMS related topics is about personal finance.
I'll have to read that one. I love those.
You are an avid reader, Grant. So I cannot compare to all the literature that you read. So.
Yeah, I'm always pounding through books, but I do love finance books, anything talking about business. That's always good to hear good recommendations. For you personally, what's the best or the most helpful kind of non-oral surgery thing that you do in your daily life that helps you with your daily OS skills?
That is a great question. I would probably have to say going to the gym, honestly, only because it doesn't necessarily help me with my skills, but it just is a release for me. Having that small amount of time during the day to let your mind kind of escape all of that, thinking about patients or other responsibilities, is good. I would say that related to my skills, my dad actually did a lot of woodworking growing up. And so I got a fair amount of experience with that. And that relates a lot to what we do on a daily basis.
Yes, we have that in common. My dad is obsessed with carpentry and measure twice, cut once, you know, all that type of a thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think of that so much if we're in the operating room, especially doing, you know, trauma or osteotomies or something like that. It's very relatable.
Yep. All right. What type of forceps do you use to remove tooth number 14?
Tooth number 14. I would go with just the regular maxillary universal forceps.
Nothing universal.
Yeah, nothing too fancy.
Do you even extract teeth anymore, or do you just tell the residents, go extract
Hey, you got to keep the lights on, Grant. I take out a lot of teeth.
Okay.
As much as I love doing facial cosmetic surgery, I am not near to the point of many of probably some of the people you've had on this podcast who can support their practice by that. So I take out a lot of teeth every single day. Root tips for dental students, you know, a lot of teeth.
When you're taking out single rooted teeth, premolars and lowers, are you also using the universals, or do you use the ash, or what other stuff do you use?
For mandibular single rooted teeth, I do go to the ash. Yep. But I've seen too many residents break off maxillary anterior teeth with the ash. So I don't use the ash for maxillary anterior teeth or bicuspid stuff. So.
Good to know. What is the best movie or series you've seen in the past year? Do you have time for watching shows?
Ooh, this is pretty cliche. I know it's probably one of the most popular in the past couple of years, but I do love Yellowstone. And the prequel to that one, actually, gosh, I'm blanking out. Was it 18? Have you watched any of those?
I have, and I've watched a little bit of Yellowstone, but not the related ones.
Yeah, so whatever the prequel to that is with Tim McGraw in it, I actually liked better. It's a really short series, so if you don't have a lot of time, you could probably watch that one instead of Yellowstone. That one gets kind of drawn out, but
awesome. Good to know. I'm glad you said Yellowstone. That's a tough. I thought you were going to say the Barbie movie. I was like, phew, he said Ooh. Yellowstone. No, just kidding. Nothing wrong with that. Okay. What's your favorite quote? Do you have a quote or something you repeat or like?
Let me see here. I'm racking my brain.
It's got to be something you tell the residents on a daily basis that they're constantly.
You know, I'm trying to think of the Steve Fontaine quote. I mean, honestly, one quote that I always think of is one I'm going to have to, well, I'll quote Dr. Niamtu on this, is something like this. I might be paraphrasing, but always be a teacher and always be a student.
Like that.
I think of that phrase all the time. No matter how senior you are, you know, as a surgeon or going through your career, there's always something that you can learn from someone else. So I think that's something to keep in mind.
I love that quote. That's so awesome. And always be a teacher too, because there's we learn so much stuff, but sometimes we don't see ourselves in the teacher role, and we let teaching opportunities slip by when we should have kind of used that knowledge to teach others.
Absolutely. And I tell our senior residents that all the time, you know, and really something that we try to instill in them. So that is something actually that pops into my head all the time.
Well, I've enjoyed thoroughly speaking with you today. It'd be great to connect down the road and do another episode. If there are listeners who have further questions about anything we've discussed today, are you okay with them contacting you or contacting me to contact you? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. They could actually just email my personal email. So full disclosure, I am actually going to be joining the University of Pittsburgh and UPMC next year as full-time faculty. But my personal email is Hawkins Daniel. So Hawkins Daniel, Daniel, the number 5 at gmail.com.
Sounds good. I'll put that in our show notes if you're okay with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, Dan, you're the man. Excited for you and your career and all the fun stuff you got coming up, and been great talking to you.
Awesome. Really appreciate the opportunity to be on.
Sounds good. Have a good rest of the day.
You too.
Okay, bye. Bye. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. For more information on these podcasts, please visit everydayoralsurgery.com. I love feedback and would be very grateful if you would reach out to me via my email, grantstuckey@gmail.com, and let me know what you thought of this episode. Or you can text me at 720-441-6059. Additionally, if you have any topics you'd like to hear about, or if you'd like to be a guest on the podcast, please, please email or text me. I found many of my interviewees through people who have been contacting me and have been listening, and I've gotten so many great ideas for more podcasts, and that's what helps keep the podcast rolling. So really appreciate you making that extra effort and helping me out
with feedback and knowing what to do next on the podcast. Thank you so much.